Here she comes.
Let's bring the meeting back to.
You're doing a great job.
This afternoon, I'm going to ask people who are speaking to the board to please keep their comments brief and to the point. And we will start off with public comment for those who were not able to be here for this morning's public comment period. Do we have a list?
Oh, yes.
Okay. And I believe Vic, Elaine, and Ken would like to come up together as a panel.
No, not really.
No? Vic, I was just doing what I was told.
I wasn't informed, you see. What happens when you volunteer to become the next president of the organization, you don't get informed of anything anymore.
We're going to cut down to a 2-minute opportunity.
Well, mine will take about 30 seconds if I'm being fast.
Fantastic. Please introduce yourself.
I will. Chairman Bernath and members of the Forest Practices Board, I am Victor Musselman. I am here today as a member of the Washington Farm Forestry Association to talk briefly about the template that we have proposed, or that the WFA has proposal and sent to you at a meeting last February. This template proposes numerous optional prescriptions for thinning of or hardwood conversion along both fish and non-fish bearing streams in western Washington. The proposed RMZ widths are 75 feet, 50 feet, or 25 feet on each side of the stream, depending on the bank full width, but with no tie to site quality as delineated by DNR soil maps. These proposed RMZ widths are clearly narrower than existing rule, such as 90 to 200 feet. It has now come to our attention that many TFW policy stakeholders have readily assumed that such narrow RMZ widths would provide less protection than rule. WFFA believes this frequent assumption is not supported by science for at least two reasons. First, the amount of protection provided by Westside Rule is unknown, so no valid comparison is possible. For example, the amount of shade and large wood recruitment to streams by current rule has never been qualified by effectiveness studies through the Adaptive Management Program. We can only assume that the amount of protection to these and other riparian functions is adequately provided by current rule. I emphasize the word assume. Secondly, the scientific evidence in our proposal, which supports our proposed prescriptions, has not been refuted by the AMP. Although the AMP recommended both a policy and science track for responding to the WFFA template proposal, the science track has not been implemented. Therefore, the members of the TFW policy has no scientific basis for rejecting the estimates of the shade and large wood recruitment that are provided in the WFFA template proposal. Although WFFA very much appreciates the efforts thus far expended by a subcommittee that is currently working on our proposal through TFW policy, we urge that rejection or acceptance of any of our proposed prescriptions must be based on current best available science, as is the definition of the AMP process. Thank you very much. If any questions?
Chair
Chairman Bernath and members of the board, I'm Ken Miller, representing Washington Farm Forestry Association. After over a year in the adaptive management program, I'm assuming or hoping that Mark Engel's subsequent report will be more encouraging than what we've been hearing, or perhaps assuming. What little we are hearing sounds more like the multiple prior efforts that were stymied in TFW policy because, I believe, there was not a real consensus about the 1999 legislative intent. Alternate harvest restrictions on smaller harvests that may have a relatively low impact on aquatic resources and some supporting language. Or maybe the impasses have been simply, hey, we got our deal and we aren't going to accept any additional risk on our aquatic resources, even if they are low impact. Relatively low impact was never specifically defined. But as some have noted, it certainly could be inferred to be anything similar to the exempt 20-acre rules adopted in the same legislation. Our current science-based draft template coincidentally also looks at the stream width as the most logical driver of the RMZ width. Our hope in this effort was that TFW policy folks unable to support the legislative intent for smalls surely would be moved by low-risk, science-based prescriptions. Best available science is the cornerstone of the adaptive management program. Yet there appears to be no effort towards a review of the science included in our proposal. If TFW folks can't support legislative intent, agree on the meaning of relatively low impact, nor support a robust review of the best available science, why do we have an adaptive management program? Aren't we putting the whole adaptive management program and HCP at risk by not dealing with the 16-year-old commitment to small forest landowners? In closing, I'm betting a few on this board, and perhaps even some in TFW policy, still don't have a clear picture in their minds of our proposal. It's science-based, written by scientists, so it's necessarily written in complex language that most of us perhaps aren't supposed to understand. I can't remember 3 minutes worth of testimony without reading, but I could easily explain and visually demonstrate the template for you at our local tree farm. Wouldn't it be helpful for the adaptive management folks to see what our proposal looks like on the ground, along with a visual of why the legislature included that deference to smalls? Are the small forest landowners important enough for the board to schedule a field trip? That's your cue, Steve. Are there any questions?
Lynn?
Going to switch gears here a little bit. We're going to move from west side to east side. Chairman Bernath and members of the board, I'm Elaine O'Neill. I'm the executive director of the Washington Farm Forestry Association. Today I want to give you an update on the status of the east side riparian template. Both of these gentlemen have been talking about the west side. It's been submitted since February of 2015. As with the west side, we did a science-based approach, took a scientific bent towards understanding of how to provide look at east side rules that would perhaps provide a more simple economical approach that can be easily implemented by small forest landowners. So we started that endeavor last May, and then the conflagration last year, which burned over a million acres, and I know on tribal lands over a billion board feet was lost last year. And that what that did for us was bring into sharp focus the reason that the east side rules were developed. They were developed to allow management of riparian zones for forest health as well as protection of habitat and water quality. Our scientific analysis, and this is where I put on my doctor hat, They use CEMER data sets, that's your data sets that were collected as part of adaptive management. And they looked at those riparian inventories in eastern Washington. They showed that when the fire hits the zones, the loss of shade is a critical function under current rule, under all available shade, under a number of different scenarios that we looked at with buffers ranging from 30 to 100 feet, you lose between 70 to 100% of your shade, or your trees, I should say, for over 80% of the riparian stand inventories. 65% of those, you had 100% mortality. There's still some stands that have large fire-resistant species. The mortality there was maybe less than 20%, but that's less than 10% of your stands. In other words, business as usual will not work given our existing inventories, even in normal fire years. If we're dealing with the extreme kind of weather conditions we've faced in the past 2 years, if that's the new norm, the situation will only amplify. Our members believe this is unacceptable for water quality, for fish habitat, and for our own goals as stewards of the land. For that reason, we're working to develop these alternative prescriptions in the Eastside template that reflects this reality. I have to say that those prescriptions will not be as good as current rule to protect functions if there is no fire, but they will certainly stand a better chance than rule of maintaining critical functions when the fire does occur. And we truly believe it's not when, or if it's when. We are greatly concerned the current process and project may result in missed opportunities to test critical elements of the natural system. And if nothing else, the fires of the last 2 years have shown that there really are no artificial boundaries called riparian reserves, riparian buffers, or even ownership reserves. We're very much looking forward to working through this process with all participants in the adaptive management program, particularly with tribal partners who understand the importance of working with fire as opposed to pretending that it doesn't exist on this landscape. It's been much longer than we anticipated to move this proposal forward to the board. We're hoping for August, more likely it will be November. So that's your update. Any questions?
Member Gerard Store, excuse me.
Thank you. I guess I am uncomfortable sitting here and hearing this discussion come to us again and again, and I know we have, I believe we're at an impasse, at least pretty close to one, in policy in terms of moving this forward. And I hear concerns around the applicability of a template approach to this, or issues around, you know, there are other better tools to get us to where we need to be. And I'm very sympathetic towards finding some solution here. The reason I'm uncomfortable is that I'm worried that we overpromised. I mean, when we took this on, this issue on, I think we indicated several times that the plate was full for policy. We got water typing, that's a high priority. We have Clean Water Act issues that are a high priority. We have a dynamic that I think we're going to talk about later where, for one reason or another, the CEMER and the policy processes and the consensus-based approach there isn't getting us to where we need to be very quickly anyway. And I'm concerned about trying to sit here and look you guys in the eye every meeting when you come forward and ask for movement on this, because I'm not sure we can perform. I mean, I'm not sure we can get you where you need to be. So I lay that out there because I feel this way every time this comes up, and I think we either need to give these folks an answer sometime soon about our ability to actually get this done in a timely way, or some other path forward, or you know, or we can't do it. We can't do it this year. We can't do it until whenever. So I just had to say that.
Okay. And we'll hear an update on where policy is in a few minutes. Any other questions for the panel? Thank you.
Thank you.
Mary Skrulla.
Good afternoon, Chair Burnett, members of the board. My name is Mary Skrulla. I'm the Conservation Caucus representative to the Policy Committee. And I just had a couple of things I'm going to speak to very briefly. I don't have any written remarks for you just at the moment. I understand at least one other person has already testified with regard to the staff report from Mark Hicks regarding clean water milestones and failure to meet key clean water milestones. And I wanted to just draw to your attention that you received something that's quite a bit more than just a chart that says we're on or off track. There's some pretty insightful recommendations in there about the need for all echelons of the adaptive management program to take a hard look at itself and make some changes. And I just wanted to let you know that I was pretty encouraged by the conversation that we had at the last policy meeting, pretty much a commitment around the table to try to sort of start immediately in terms of calling out problems and finding solutions and to try to somehow squeeze this idea of a sort of structural hard look at ourselves into the agenda. And but the key to that is going to be it's going to require board oversight. So just to put something else on your plate there, I think that just like with any big problem, the initial issue is to recognize you have one. And everybody's trying to take some ownership of it. But I do think we need to sort of thingify the problems and address them in a methodical way. So I really encourage, I recommend some careful attention to the memo there. Also real briefly, just to package up the things that are not action items for you, the PI on unstable slopes. We have received that. You'll hear a briefing later from the co-chair and possibly from the AMPA, or maybe not on the agenda. Notwithstanding the serious concerns that the Conservation Caucus had about the failure to include subject matter in the board manual, about which you will hear later, that does not mean that I won't put everything I can into getting a good result from the adaptive management program. And while it may take a little bit longer than we had hoped, I think there are some issues that may be able to be resolved in a month or two and produce recommendations for board manual changes or possibly rule or some other resolution. It looks like it'll be about a year before we can address some of the issues requiring technical information, but we don't know that yet. We're still looking at it, and I just wanted to let you know that we're doing everything we can, and we may actually be making some progress on that between now and August. So I appreciate that, and I will leave it to DNR to report on the small forest landowner group. I just also want you to know that folks have been trying to work on that. I do think that people have bent over backwards to respect this proposal. And frankly, I believe it was within the board's contemplation that we would do more than just look at the proposal and evaluate it and say yes or no. That we're trying to find something in here that looks like it has a future, and I think there has been adequate resources dedicated to it, but it's not an easy issue. So, thank you.
Chris Mendoza.
Good afternoon, board members. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today. I have two things I'd like to go over, and I guess I'll reverse the order. The one issue I was going to speak to dovetail with Mary's testimony about supporting Mark Hicks' memo that was submitted to the board on the adaptive management program processes. And I guess I'd like to just start out reminding folks that you know, the way CMER interacts with policy is laid out in the board manual. The way we interact with the board is laid out in section 22 of the board manual. And I think we all understand that CMER and policy all work for you folks and trying to advance issues. I think that having been on CMER and co-chair for 5 years, that I can confidently say that 95% of the time, we've done a pretty good job of getting our studies done. I think particularly when it was under federal funding, You know, in 10 years, we spend close to $30 million, about $3 million a year on doing research on little tools, some effectiveness monitoring, other things. So overall, CMER functions really well when it operates in accordance with the board manual guidance and also in our protocols and standards. However, you know, having said that, I think that the few times things do get off track is when the firewall that exists between CMER and policy gets breached. And occasionally it does. And in those times, when policies sort of infiltrate what is supposed to be a rigorous scientific process, then it can throw a wrench into things. And things can get stalled out, a lot of things can happen. Having presided over disputes before at CMER, I think that for the most part they resolve themselves. But in some cases they don't. And I think now with the master schedule in place and funding in place, I think it would be a good idea. I know that in WAC it states that the program go through periodic review. And although CMER has gone through two reviews, we've gone through the LEAN process, as you know, and are administering pilot projects under LEAN. We've gone through independent review by Stillwater Sciences that looked at our research strategy, and we responded accordingly. We are the only arm of the AMP that has gone through that. The policy hasn't gone through any sort of review, nor has the board interaction in that regard. So I would encourage that that to happen. Secondly, I'd like to speak to is an issue about ED&A, and I'll be brief on this, and this is sort of, I guess, emblematic of, or symptomatic of what I just spoke to. The board cast three motions, as you know, on how to deal with moving to a permanent water typing rule. And one of the motions is to look at ways to reduce e-fishing. And CMER made a recommendation recently to pursue something called eDNA, and I don't know if you've heard about it, some of you have. It's a less intrusive way to sample waters and determine whether there's critters living in the water, and if so, what type. It's a metabarcoding system. It's relatively new with genome sequencing. And there's great promise in using it to do so as a potential replacement in the future. So we made a recommendation to dovetail with the Pacific Northwest Research Station to look at, in the future, potentially conducting research on whether this would be a viable option. Moved it through, saw no really controversy to policy, and then it was killed there. So you know, we had one dissenting vote, and the study quickly went off track. So I think this is an example of how we had an opportunity to actually work with a collaborator, in this case the Pacific Northwest Research Station, to really pursue a viable option to alternatives to electrofishing in the future that was eliminated very quickly. And now the point has passed where we can do that. So if we were to pick this up again, it'll cost us, you know, 5 to 10 times as much money to do, whereas we could have saved a fortune and jumped on board with other folks that are looking at a similar future. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Heather Hansen, please.
So I have handouts.
I'll take them.
Okay. Thanks. And those are different than my testimony. I wanted to be able to provide some background. My name is Heather Hansen, and I represent Washington Friends of Farms and Forests. Most of the timber companies, as well as the agricultural organizations in Washington, are members. For nearly 30 years, we've promoted science-based regulation of pesticides and improved understanding about pesticide use. Pesticide regulation can be as arcane as the IRS code. We know that. Much of what we do is trying to take the fear out of pesticide use and help people understand the benefits, such as controlling invasive species to improve habitat. For example, the Nature Conservancy uses lots of herbicides for that purpose. We also support stringent regulation and enforcement of pesticide law. We agree that the current forest practices application does not provide clear, easy to understand information. We approached DNR earlier this spring about improving the form
to help provide more usable information for everyone. We are committed to working with all interested parties and DNR to improve communication. After all, it's in the landowner's best interest to have good communication, not only with their neighbors, but with the public as a whole. And many landowners voluntarily notify their neighbors prior to application, but that's not always as easy as it sounds. People move, there's rental property, various other things sometimes make it very difficult to figure out who you're supposed to notify. Changes in the weather also cause frequent changes to spray schedules, and so an individual could be notified multiple times without an application ever taking place, and that just gets complicated and confusing for everyone. And for what purpose? EPA labels and forest practices regulations are written to protect water, wildlife, and people. While drift can happen, it is rare and it is illegal. If a citizen suspects that drift may have occurred, it should be reported to the Department of Agriculture. Department of Ag has delegated authority from EPA to enforce federal pesticide law in the same way that Ecology has delegated authority to enforce the Clean Water Act. And then WSDA also enforces Washington Pesticide Application Act. Washington state law also requires health practitioners, Poison Center, Department of Ag, LNI, any other state agency that gets a report of a suspected pesticide exposure, they're required to report to Department of Health. County health departments also are required to report any pesticide exposure to Department of Health. And then DOH investigates those cases and compiles statistics. The extremely few events that have been reported in forestry have involved helicopter company employees, not neighbors, and all of them were, or all of them, all two of them in the past 5 years, involved equipment malfunctions, not drift. Most commercial forest land in Washington is managed on a 40 to 60 year rotation cycle. Herbicides are applied at most 2 to 3 times during that 40 to 60 year period, and just before and after planting time. Herbicides are only aerial applied to harvested areas, so they're not applied in buffers. They're used to control not only the spread of invasive species, but also to allow young trees access to sunshine and space to grow. Without herbicides, it would be very difficult to establish new forests, and I would be happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Heather. Karen Torger.
Good afternoon again, Chairman Nathan, members of the board. My name is Karen Terwilliger, for the record, from the Washington Forest Protection Association. I'm the senior forester there. And I just wanted to make a few remarks about the Clean Water Act Assurances document that is presented in the staff reports from Mark Hicks. As with other folks that have been up to testify about this specific issue, we took a very strong look at the report and took it very much to heart. I think that over time, the Clean Water Act assurances have probably not been as high a priority on a day-to-day work basis as water typing and unstable slopes, two of the priorities that the board has put on our plate as the priorities for going forward. But we are, as in the landowner community, are very dedicated and committed to making sure that the Clean Water Act assurances are met. And so to that end, I have a couple of comments and maybe suggestions for policy and the board as we go forward. First up, we're in the process of looking at the budget for the 2017-19 biennium. And there are some elements of the Clean Water Act assurances report that Mark Hicks put forward that relate to budget issues for particular studies. And so I think that looking at those studies during that budget process is important. Secondly, looking at workload priorities for both CEMA and policy may also be an analysis that we need to go through in this process. And then third, I think we need to understand that these are very complex issues, and we need to have the opportunities and time to be able to address them, as well as the processes in place to do that. During the settlement agreement process and timeframe, we developed a lean process for the leaning, the CEMA study process. And I'm not so sure that lean process was as effective as we wanted it to be. It's currently still in the pilot process status, but there may be some information and discussion between SEMA and policy that needs to take place in order to make that process better. And then finally, I think the commitment and recommitment to the TFW ground rules, as well as the items in the Forest and Fish Report, the Clean Water Assurances, and the Forest and Fish HCP, is really important in this process. And that includes not just SEMA and not just policy, but I think also the higher levels in our organizations at the principals level. There have been several comments, and I think Mark made this in the assurances report that he put forward, that the principals need to be involved in the process. And actually, in the settlement agreement, I think there was a requirement to meet at least once and maybe twice a year on a principals level. Not to necessarily redirect specific priorities or change a direction, but to reinvigorate the spirit that we have in terms of the discussions at the table. As I said, these are very complex issues. It's a consensus-based process is very difficult to go through. And I think one key ground rule of the day, or the ground rule that we put forward in the TFW process that we needs to be reinvigorated, is that we all need to own each other's issues. And we need to understand that questions that come forward are legitimate and need to be dealt with before we move forward, but we need to do it in a timely manner. So I'd be more than happy to answer questions if you have any. Otherwise, thank you.
Thank you, Karen. Okay.
Steve, excuse me, Chair. I'm sorry, I didn't sign up on that, please.
Is it on something other than what you spoke about this morning?
Oh, yes, yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Chair, I also...
Yes, I know, Bruce.
Thank you.
Gotcha.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be brief. I'd like to just raise an important issue that might be somewhat abstract and academic, but it's really important to everything the board does, and it's the role of the board manual versus a rule. And it's a really important distinction, and in all my years here, I don't think we've ever really had this discussion, but I just wanted to put it out there as food for thought for the board.
So wouldn't you rather have this during the board manual discussion that we're going to have?
Well, I can, if you would prefer, but it's more, I'm not really talking about any specific board manual is the thing. It's more of a general topic. And I'm only going to go on for a couple of minutes. A rule is actually a legal entity. It's that's in the WACs. Those are the rules that we adopt or that guide the conducting of forest practices. Those are rules. They have to be adopted through the Administrative Procedures Act. And if they affect aquatic resources, they have to go through the adaptive management program, et cetera. Those are rules. A board manual is a very different animal. It's considered, but it's got features of both, but I think it's really important to get them both straight. A board manual is technical guidance. It's not a rule. No one can say, follow this provision, you have to do it. It's technical guidance, and the point of it is, because a rule only has a few words, there needs to be a document, a companion document, to sort of breathe life into the rules. How to identify something, how to delineate something, how to go about implementing the rules. So the rules are like the Constitution, and the board manual is like the statutes fulfilling the Constitution that were under the authority. But there's a lot of overlap. A lot of overlap in this world that I just want to just throw out there. For example, it's in the rules that one shall not log in a channel migration zone. And that's it. It just says no logging in a channel migration zone. But what is a channel migration zone? Where is it? What are its limits? How do you find them? What kind of rivers have them? Et cetera. That's all in a board manual. Type F, the fish presence issue. Excluding fish presence is all done in a board manual through the electronic protocol, how to go out and e-fish, and how do you do it, what times a year can you do it, et cetera. That's all in a board manual. Logging on steep and unstable slopes. We have a list with two or three what are considered dangerous landforms, the glacial deep-seated landslides and the recharge areas of them. And then we have the type F, which is the category F, which is the landforms exhibiting unstable features. But that's it in the rule. But we have a board manual that you are going to adopt today, or consider anyway for adoption today, that has 80 pages of how those work. How, you know, you identify these landforms and where are they, what are their limits, and how can one conduct forest practices around them. So there is a significant overlap in these two things. I think the purpose of what I'm saying is that I urge the board to be really careful that anything that the board adopts in a board manual cannot undercut a rule. A rule is what you've already decided and put into a book and say, this is worth protecting and needs to be protected. So it's really, as we go about the whole board manual issue, or for any issue this board is in front, it's really important to sort of separate those two out and think about them differently, and not do in a board manual what needs to be done in a rule. So thou cannot repeal a rule in a board manual. And vice versa, one cannot make a rule in a board manual. It's a tricky situation, but that's where we are. I urge you to consider that as you go about doing this important work. Thank you.
Thank you, Peter. Bruce Barnes.
Good afternoon, board. My name is Bruce Barnes. I live in Vancouver, Washington, and I thank you for allowing me to speak. I thought this was at 1:30, but I got some important information. You know, this is the third time that I've been to this forest practice board, and I want to bring to your attention that, you know, the forest practices have been put in place since the 70s. I'm an elk hunter. I enjoy the outdoors, but I have a great concern for the future generations of people that are using the forest. And one of them is that just since 2014, they put a database together for complaints, right? For aerial herbicide spraying. So far there's been 6 ag complaints, 2 forest complaints. There's no monitoring of gallons that are being sprayed in the forest, right? So the chemical is cheap, but the helicopter is extremely expensive. So there's no oversight. These people are out spraying things that who knows how many gallons are being sprayed on the ground. You go to Oil Can Henry's, you go to a gas filling station, they monitor how many gallons of oil are being put in your car or how many gallons of fuel. We have no monitoring in this state for how many gallons are being dumped on the ground. We have another debate in this state about, you know, bringing in oil terminals into the state because it's a petroleum-based chemical. But the sticking agent that they're spraying on the ground is petroleum-based. I mean, it'd be no different than me going and dumping my motor oil in a stream bed, right? So all this stuff's going down the streams into our drinking water, right? My bigger concern is, though, that I've talked to a couple of chemists since I've been here the last time, and a couple of microbiologists, and we've also found 33 elk laying on the ground dying of what looks to be pneumonia while they're foaming at the mouth. They're telling me that these chemicals attack the lungs and the small capillaries in these lungs. I've got videos on my phone today to show anybody would like to see them. And I'm very concerned about our elk herd because our Fish and Wildlife has also said that these elk are only living to 3.5 years old now. They're not breeding correctly. And when I go to Mount St. Helens this year, I see 330 elk up there in the wildlife refuge, but there's only 2 calves. How do we sustain an elk herd that is sick? Our Fish and Wildlife really has no idea what's killing them. They're saying it's treponema, but only 7 of the elk tested have this, which is a secondary virus, right? So it brings me to my conclusion here. I would like to see this board form a committee that investigates the chemicals that are being sprayed. Because as the lady that came up here to defend the chemicals said, anybody that needs this information, I can go over and we can all work together. But we're not working together because the only thing that's being protected is listed in endangered species. Elk, deer, bear, cougar, grouse, any of the coyotes, any of the bobcats, they're not listed or endangered, right? It's only salmon, grizzly bears, those type of things that really, you know, they matter, but we're hunting for these animals. We're consuming these animals. We have no idea what's in these animals' bloodstream. But I did attend the house session down in Oregon this year that dealt with the Triangle Lake incident where the people were sprayed down there. And basically what some of the council members said is these people are inept. And they're gonna legislate laws this year to do away with aerial herbicide spraying. So I'm wondering why this state is not getting on board and saying enough's enough. There's other ways to do this. When you look at an MSDS sheet, which, by the way, the people that are out in the forest aren't getting, so they're not knowing what they're being in contact with. Because I'm an electrician. When I go out to a job, guess what I get? I get an MSDS sheet from a paint can to asbestos on the job, and it tells me what the dangers are, what the consequence is, what happens, what the research has been. I don't see any of this being given to foresters. So I would again urge this group to put together, like the HFRA committee at the Fish and Wildlife, a public committee, not built of fish and wildlife people and special interest groups, but of the public that has, you know, a vested interest because they're buying hunting licenses or paying taxes in the state, not built of politicians from the communities, but an actual group of people that will take a really good look at this, right? Because they spray these chemicals on the ground, but they don't have any information for what happens when they mix them all together. So that would be my comments for the day. I do appreciate the opportunity to speak here. It's a sunny day. I'm sure there's a lot of people that don't want to be here. So, you know, and I'm very concerned. I'm concerned for our wildlife. I'm concerned for my drinking water. I'm concerned for my 15-year-old having the same opportunities that I've had in my lifetime in this great Northwest. But our motto has always been clean, green, and pristine. I don't see that. And it's really up to this board here to make sure, in the governor's office, to make sure that we have that clean, green, and pristine state that everybody wants to move to, still be here for our future generations. So I thank you for your time. Have a good day.
Thank you, Bruce. Okay, moving on down the agenda, Mark.
Jeffrey has asked for some time and then general comment.
Hi. 2 minutes?
That's all I need. And it's only because I had thought that I'd be getting some offering some closing comments at the end of our session, and there wasn't time for that. So I just want to read to you the letter that I have prepared for the board instead. And so, the TFW Tribal Caucus Group has determined that they would like to submit a more formalized set of comments and recommendations pertaining to today's cultural resources discussions, and we want to provide that right away. So just wanted to give you the heads up, we'll be submitting something more formalized. The caucus also wishes to invite the Forest Practices Board Chair and any other Forest Practices Board members to attend the next meeting of the TFW Tribal Caucus, which is being scheduled for the second week of June. So we'd really like to have you there. In fact, we'd probably bring you in at the end of the meeting after we got ourselves ready and just really figured out what it is that we'd like to talk about. And then finally, the caucus would also like to request that the Forest Practices Board provide them with a memo describing the actions that they, the Forest Practices Board, are now planning to be taking next pertaining to the cultural resources topic. So that's all there is, and I'd be happy to just leave this letter with you, and that's all I needed to say.
Hand it to Patricia, please.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
So, next agenda item, please. Western gray squirrels. Brandon and Terry, you can come up and be brief and to the point.
Well, good morning, Board Chair and members of the board. My name is Terry Jackson. I'm Forest Habitat Section Manager for Parker Fish and Wildlife.
And I'm with Brandon Austin, Forest Practices.
Okay. How about she? We said we'd be great and it's good to. Okay, well, we're here today to give you the brief talking points from the Western Gray Squirrel Annual Report to the Board. And this annual report deals with a little bit about the background of the Western Gray Squirrel, what we're doing, and information on the voluntary management approach. So just to give you a brief background, I know you've gotten an update on this many times before, so this will be brief. but the western gray squirrel was state listed as threatened back in November of 1993. And as you know, the Department of Fish and Wildlife has done a recent periodic status review that I'll be speaking to you in a moment about the results of that. The species inhabits oak woodlands and conifer forest, and it nests both in cavities that you see up in this right-hand corner. I know that's a hard picture to see. And then in nest, in stick nest in trees. And as far as the distribution, they used to be more widespread, but now they're in three localized populations in the oak woodlands and conifer forest of the Klickitat and South Yakima counties. And they're in the low to mixed elevation conifer forest in the North Cascades, Okanagan, and Chelan counties. And then in the oak woodlands and conifer forest of Joint Base Lewis McChord, and that's Thurston and Pierce counties. As far as threats to the species, we have habitat loss and fragmentation, sheep grazing, and they have disease and mange issues. And for the habitat loss and fragmentation, it's a lot of land conversion, loss of oak woodlands, logging, fires.
This is just a brief history of the what was decided in 2013 in order to provide improvements to the voluntary management approach of the Western Gray Squirrel. DNR and the Department of Fish and Wildlife worked together to make some administrative and operational improvements. These improvements included putting a note on a presence of potential Western Gray Squirrel sightings or habitat on the DNR office checklist, notifying the Washington State Department of Fish and Wildlife, the DNR Forest Practice Forester, and interested stakeholders of potential hits of the Western Gray Squirrel on proposed forest practice applications. A note that include on the FPA decision page of potential presence and refers applicants to contact the Department of Fish and Wildlife staff for assistance in an annual report to the board, which is here. And for the forest practice application notification processing, how we accomplish these goals is all FPAs and notifications are screened for potential impacts to the Western Gray Squirrel using the Department of Fish and Wildlife's habitat database. The database looks at the presence of net and presence of the Western Gray Squirrel, nests in the various states that the nests can be found in, and any potentially suitable habitat. Fish and Wildlife is notified of any potential impacts within a quarter mile. And then the Department of Fish and Wildlife habitat biologists will do additional screening, and often the forest practice forester in the course of their site visits and review of the FPAs will also assist Fish and Wildlife in that additional screen.
Okay, so starting in December of 2013, Gary Bell from our department started tracking all the FPAs that he screens that comes from DNR. And this is the data, I'm gonna show you right now the data from January 1st through December 31st, 2015. So in total, there were 79 FPAs that had possible Western Gray Squirrel hits. 56 of those were in Klickitat County, 16 were in the Okanagan, and one was in Clark County. And of those 73 FPAs, 25 were with large forest landowners and 48 were small forest landowners. And so of those 73 FPAs, all of them needed further review. And what our staff does, our regional staff, is they go out in the field and they look for presence of Western Gray Squirrels or their nest. So of those 73 FPAs, 52 did not require any additional work as far as management plans. 36 of those had no squirrels or nest. 16 of those FPAs were associated with the Carlton Complex salvage. And then, so of those 73, that there were 21 that required Western Gray Squirrel management plans, and 11 of those were with large forest landowners, 10 were small forest landowners. And of those 21, two included maybe less than ideal protection. The nests were left, but maybe not some additional trees such as buffers or corridors or such. Those are small forest landowners. And we have to recognize too that we often have issues, or small forest landowners have a hard time often with this because of economical constraints. So I think you might be aware that we did, Department of Fish and Wildlife conducted periodic status review last year, and in January of 2016, staff presented that status review to the Washington Fish and Wildlife Commission. And as far as the summary of that periodic status review, because of the species' relatively small population size, the continuing threats, and lack of information suggesting that either the population had reached downlisting goals or substantially declined since 2005, the Fish and Wildlife Commission took action in January to keep the Western Gray Squirrel listed as they currently were as state threatened. But with that said, one of the major issues is that we don't have enough data. And so we've been involved in some surveys. We're picking up doing more and more surveys on population estimates and habitat. So there's a three-year survey being conducted between 2015 and 2017 statewide throughout those populations we mentioned earlier. They're hair tube surveys, and there's a picture of one at the bottom. And this is to determine their distribution and to gather data that would factor into their abundance as well. And then on Joint Base Lewis-McChord, there's research going on to look at the effects of their forest practices on the Western Gray Squirrel and their habitat. Within the next 3 years, not sure why this is not showing up, Scott. There's gonna be evaluation of the habitat change occurring in Klickitat County as far as evaluation of the impacts of the fires on Western Gray Squirrel habitat in the North Cascades. And I wanted to bring up a couple of other landowner efforts that are going on. You've probably heard with the last annual report we provided that Hancock Forest Management has been conducting research over the past couple of years in Klickitat County. And their research is working on a model for probability of nest detection, quantifying relationship between nest and Western Gray Squirrel abundance, and also qualifying the use of the response to forest management. And then wanted to bring up an effort that Gary Bell from our staff has been working with SDS Lumber Company to try to develop. He wants to develop a landscape management plan, and they've been working together on trying to get that going. And we think that will be a great approach if we can make this one work well, that we can use it as a start for how we might work with other landowners on landscape management plans. And these plans would be incorporating our priority habitats and species management recommendations. And then last of all, just some notes on moving forward. In addition to the ongoing efforts that we're doing with cooperating with DNR on screening of FPAs and tracking of our FPAs and management plans, there are several things that we need, obviously, and that's continuing to get more data on distribution and abundance, as well as additional resources and funding for effectiveness and compliance monitoring. With the tracking data that we've been conducting on FPAs and the management plans, that doesn't include after the fact you know, data to go out and see effectiveness or compliance. It pretty much includes what's happening before. And from that perspective, it looks like we're doing pretty good with a voluntary management approach, but we really need to pick up post-harvest monitoring to see how well we're doing. And then to continue to explore more opportunities for landscape management approaches. And then trying to look for other economic incentives for small forest landowners, because I know that we continue to add more that we want them to do to help us with conservation, but we need to help them to be able to provide that. And just a note on that, when we do work with small forest landowners, when there's an FPA that does have a hit, our staff do go out and work with them on a one-on-one basis to try to come up with ways to reach both our conservation goals and to help them to reach their goals as well. So, is there any questions?
Questions for board members on the annual report and the species status report. Board member Storr.
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chair. Thanks, folks, for the presentation. Just a note of maybe a trend here, this economic incentives issue, both here with the squirrels and also, you know, that's come up with the spotted owl as a potential need. As DNR's thinking about budget, Mr. Chair, as you talked about earlier, you know, perhaps there's some room to consider some of those as they go forward. So.
Okay, thank you. Mark, while you come up, I'll just I want to remind the board where we are on petitions for rulemakings on Western Grade Squirrels. As you remember, we received a petition for rulemaking last November, and at the time the board denied the petition, but also realized that we would be revisiting the Western Grade Squirrel at this meeting, because the annual report was due and the species status was going to be reported. We've notified the petitioner that we were having this on the agenda today, and they resubmitted the petition, and so that's why this part of the agenda is here, is to consider that petition and take appropriate action. So, Mark, you want to take it from there?
And good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the board. Again, I'm Mark Engel, Assistant Division Manager for Policy Services and Forest Practices Division. I'm going to cover the requirements of a rule petition and a little information about the petition, and especially how it pertains to the presentation you just received. Any person may submit a petition to the board requesting the adoption, amendment, or repeal of any forest practices rule. Board staff received on April 20th a petition for rulemaking for the Western Gray Squirrel. The petition requests the board to amend the Class 4 Special Threatened Endangered Species (CEPA) Policies Rule, specifically WAC 222-10040 Sub 1 and Sub 2, to evaluate the impacts of forest practices on the Western Gray Squirrel conservation measures through consultation with the Department of Fish and Wildlife, other agencies with expertise, affected landowners, affected Indian tribes, and others with expertise too, and to determine whether forest practices reasonably would be expected directly or indirectly to reduce appreciably the likelihood of the survival or recovery of the gray squirrel in this case, by reducing the reproduction numbers and distribution of the species. The petition also asks the board to amend the same rule in sub 3 to add the 1996 Western Gray Squirrel Guidelines. Now, those were attached in the petition that you all received. As you consider the requested rulemaking of the petition, keep in mind the key information that you just received in the Western Gray Squirrel report, that in January of this year, the Fish and Wildlife Commission decided to maintain the status of the Western Gray Squirrel as a state threatened species based on the recent Department of Fish and Wildlife periodic status review. They found that until further data is collected, there is insufficient evidence to conclude that the species has declined since 2005. And furthermore, based on the forest practice tracking data to date, there is no conclusive evidence that additional rules are needed to adequately protect the squirrel. The Forest Practices Board will continue to receive these annual reports of the status and of the voluntary protection approach, and will and further opportunities for economic incentives for landscape manager approaches and small forest landowner incentives are being looked at. The board must no later than 60 days after receipt of a complete petition, or by May 20th of this year, initiate rulemaking proceedings in accordance with Chapter 3405 of RCW, which is the Administrative Procedures Act, or deny the petition in writing stating the reasons for the denial and specifically addressing the concerns stated in the petition. Where appropriate, the board will indicate alternative means by which the board will address the concerns raised in the petition. If the board denies the petitioner may appeal the denial to the Joint Administrative Rules Review Committee, the governor, or Superior Court. That's an outline of the petition and the actions that the board needs to consider. I think with that, I'll...
Okay. Is there any public comment, Patricia?
No.
Okay. So, Mark, does staff have a recommendation to the board on what to do with this rule petition?
Staff recommends that the board continue to receive the annual reports from DFW and DNR regarding the voluntary approach, and that staff also recommends that the board take the lead of Department of Fish and Wildlife through the Fish and Wildlife Commission in the event that the status of the squirrel is elevated. This petition did not request an addition of critical habitat within the board's critical habitat rule for state-listed TME species, which is 222-16080. But if, in the event that the squirrel's status is elevated, that is where the critical habitat would be placed, along with conditions in which the landowners must take to protect the species.
Patricia? So staff is recommending a draft motion before you. If somebody would like to move this and second it, and then I will ask for discussion by the board members.
I'll move it.
Board Member Stanley, would you read the motion, please?
Yes, sir. I move the Forest Practice Board deny the petition for rulemaking on Western Gray Squirrel Habitat. Based on Department of Fish and Wildlife's periodic status review, there is insufficient evidence to conclude that there is a need to changing the board's approach in protecting the species. I further move the Forest Practice Board continue to annually revisit the status of the voluntary protection approach.
Second, please.
Second.
Okay. Member Ballish, any discussion by the board? Board Member Storer.
Yeah, I'll say a few things. I agree with the staff recommendation. These critters aren't doing extremely well, obviously. That's why they're listed as threatened. The problem is we don't have a lot of data to tell whether they're increasing or decreasing. And we originally had them placed in a lower cohort of our periodic status reviews. with the intent of gathering that data. When the petition came in a year or so ago, we bumped that up to see what we could find out, you know, just to give them some special attention. So we need to gather more data. In the meantime, we do have some new and ongoing efforts. This landscape review and some of the survey work that we're doing is perhaps going to give us even more than what we would get through our standard survey processes. And then we see that the voluntary forest practice application review process seems to be working too. Out of the 73 that we noted and looked at, perhaps had some problems. They weren't, it wasn't like someone came in and removed the nest trees, that there just possibly wasn't enough continuity between trees or cover for the squirrels that we noted. So we got processes in place. We have improvements in terms of the data collection, need a little bit more time, and they're currently listed as threatened. So I just don't, it feels premature at this point in time to take some action.
Board Member Stanley.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to mention that seeing the initiatives Hancock and SDS has taken for the voluntary landscape plans, I think can really give some really good innovative approaches to managing the species. And it's nice to see the incentives are working on it.
Any other discussion before we take a vote on the motion? Board Member Davies?
I'll just, following up on your point, Court, that it, those incentives, and I'm not exactly sure what incentives those two companies are receiving, but we discussed, and Joe mentioned, the need for economic incentives, financial incentives for landowners, whether it's owls or the squirrel, or other species, and unless we find some money to dedicate to that, the way that conservation banking works without us finding some funding or doing some kind of regulation, there will be no market, there will be no incentive. So I just think that your point about finding some funding for these incentives is really important.
Thank you. Any other discussion? Okay, let's vote. Everybody in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed, same sign. Any abstentions? Thank you, the motion passes. Next, Mark.
Mostafar.
Or I guess we need, let's see. Yeah, Mark, you're up.
Yeah.
Thanks. So this is also a reminder on where we're at. We've heard public testimony about a small landowner, a Westside template. If you recall, a year ago, the board requested policy to review the template and identify different strategies for moving forward, and also starting a literature synthesis on riparian function in conjunction with the PHS riparian recommendations that will be coming out of Fish and Wildlife. So Mark's going to give us an update on policies work on this.
Thank you. The board at your May 2015 meeting accepted and directed the Adaptive Management Program Administrator to present to policy the Small Forest Landowner Westside Low Impact Template Proposal Initiation. Policy received the recommendations from the AMPA and initiated a policy subcommittee to review the proposed prescriptions to determine if they meet the criteria of the template, and to affirm the AMPA's recommendation contract, a literature synthesis of riparian function. This is a complete review would require that, first off, as a reminder, a template is a form of an alternate plan. And it's prescriptions that are so commonly used that we can put them into a template that any small forest landowner can then just apply the terms of the template and achieve an alternate plan. Part of the review is that the prescriptions must protect, repair, and function, meet the intent of the rules, that they have to be frequently used, and that they're meeting science. So the subcommittee has taken considerable time to review this proposal because the West Side Low Impact Template features a full suite of prescriptions and site conditions for both conifer and hardwood-dominated riparian forests, in which the prescriptions may be applied on both type F and type M waters. It's a, quite a suite of prescriptions and conditions. The subgroup has met 5 times to review the primary 13 prescriptions for type F waters. To date, they've determined 5 prescriptions that can be further vetted, determined if they meet the criteria to be considered in an alternate plan template. To complete this evaluation, the subcommittee, or to complete their analysis for type F waters, more work is required. And at present, the small forest landowner communities, specifically through WFFA, is putting together some further direction for us to understand the remaining prescriptions and conditions in which they can be used so that we can finish the review. The subcommittee can schedule their next meeting on the 23rd of May. And when this evaluation is completed, the subcommittee still needs to repeat the same evaluation process for the type N prescriptions. They need to develop questions to be used in the evaluation of the riparian function literature synthesis. Please note you have not yet addressed the fiscal year 16 and 17 CMR budget, but this is included. This literature synthesis, or money for this, is included within the fiscal year 17 budget. And as Mary Skrdelik had stated earlier, the group is really looking if any of the proposed prescriptions or if additional prescriptions could be identified and presented for policies consideration and development of recommendations to bring to the board for inclusion as additional small forest landowner templates in board manual section 21. Any questions?
Questions from board members on the update on the small landowner template? Thank you, Mark. All right, let's move on to board manual 16. On unstable slopes, Mara Radcliffe is going to come up. So, reminder to the board, at the November meeting, the board agreed to further changes in board manual 16 based on those things that were brought to us in November that were close to completion, and that the other concerns that were not close to completion would go through the adaptive management process. This agenda item is going to explain the amendments that are proposed to the board manual. And they're coming to us now because they weren't complete in February. So I'll leave it at that, and let's take it away.
Good afternoon, Chairman Athen, members of the board. I'm Mark Radcliffe, Policy Services Section, and as you know, facilitating the board manual groups through this process. And I'm here to request the board's approval of the amendments that were done in this last phase between November and today. As you may know, that in November, you did direct staff to convene a qualified expert group to address those items near resolution contained in the concerns in the Conservation Caucus memo. We interpreted near resolution to be items that the group was already working on and that we had a potential to produce a product for you in the near term. And then the board also directed DNR to place those items not in near resolution into proposal initiation to be addressed through adaptive management program. The board manual is developed by DNR with coordination from qualified experts. And the recommendations thus far before you today reflects what these groups and DNR believes is the best guidance to supplement the rules currently in place. We've been working since November, and in February I didn't ask for action, but just give you a status report. And since that November meeting, we've had 5 meetings to date with those groups. To achieve the board direction, the group reviewed 2 documents. A document on screening complex deep sea landslides, otherwise known as the ANWEEDS document. And then also a document how LIDAR can be used to identify historic runout paths of deep sea landslides. From this review, the group found useful information on 3 main subject items. The first one is we have extended the deep sea discussion in the manual to include a landslide that we define as compound. And compound is a term to describe a large landslide that has secondary or smaller landslides in the body. And this one is an existing image. It shows what we would use the term as a simple rotational slide. The red line there shows the failure plane. And this one demonstrates what we're going to define as a compound. It's a host landslide with secondary landslides embedded. Shallow rapids is a common form of this. And because there's secondary landslides, there's greater surface area that's been fractured, greater water infiltration, and as a result, sometimes greater frequency of movement with this type. So we've added some good information about these into the manual in the deep-seated section. I want to remind you that when DNR science team reviews FPAs, they evaluate landslides, hazards all the same, regardless if it's bedrock, if it's in glacial deposits, if it's a compound, highly complex, or a simple rotational. The manual is clear that when there is a potential failure to harm public resources or public safety, that landslide needs to be assessed. No hierarchy is put or a different emphasis put on a landslide. They're all case by case, and we expect the qualified experts and science team to review it that way. The second part, we've also included additional LIDAR examples showing various geomorphic features on deep sea landslides and a brief discussion of relative age, given how crisp or how fuzzy the LIDAR image shows. And lastly, we've included a discussion on how LIDAR can be used to identify historic deep sea landslide runouts in a geographical area, in a neighborhood, so to speak, and look at what's been happening in the past to help build your analysis. In your materials, you received a letter, in your board meeting materials, you received a letter expressing concerns and potential deficiencies or gaps in the manual. I want to briefly explain the context for these perceived gaps. The qualified expert group fully vetted all technical materials and proposals during these meetings. The majority of the group did not concur with all the requests. Some of it, yes, but not all. Because they either contained rule prescriptions or was inappropriate for guidance at the time. In some cases, the material was provided too late for discussion. For example, the Ann Weeks document contained material unrelated to what she had presented to the group. In addition, it contained additional group that we did not have time to consider. There is a request to classify all deep sea landslides as Category E identified landform. This cannot be achieved by the expert group, or DNR for that matter, but by simply you, the board, through the acceptance of recommendations through rule adoption. The validity of these requests will be vetted through the adaptive management program, the PI that is approved by you. In 2014, the board approved work done by the Phase 1 group. That was the first launch of this back in 2014. And that was regarding the groundwater recharge for glacial deep-sea landslides. How to assess those landslides and the accompanying groundwater discussion was researched and made relevant for landslides in glacial deposits. Suggesting specific assessments apply equally to non-glacial deposits, and that the methods for assessing the groundwater is identical to all landslides, was not recommended by this group or scientifically substantiated. Because of the narrow timeline to complete research and add material during phase one, the expert panel was unable to provide adequate transitions and introductions for the material. Because of this, the board provided time for policy representatives to review the organizational flow of the manual. As directed by the board, staff considered feedback from stakeholders from ecology, landowner caucus, environmental caucus, and DNR scientists. The outcome of those meetings removed repetitive language, improved readability, and clarification for the guidance itself. The majority of the language removed or amended was not language the expert panel had drafted, but language DNR staff had drafted to help the transitions, to help the introductions from that material. The expert panel was not convened to draft policy, certainly, but simply provide the technical methods used as guidance for the existing rules. And I do have an example, of how this was improved. The old language, or phase one language, if you will, is the first one there. And what it did is it says that the methods, the technical methods to use would be similar and the same to all landslides. And this reference was not cited. And what the group found, a better way to say that is, when there is water,